Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Justices on the state Supreme Court question the power Republicans have over legislative committees. Plus, a series of lawsuits were filed this week targeting election laws and Governor Evers' school funding veto. And we break down some of the biggest takeaways from the latest Marquette University Law School poll. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for April 19th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
I'm J.R. Ross.
We're going to start with SCOTUS arguments that happened earlier this week about Evers' lawsuit that targets the power that Republicans have on many legislative committees. Now, this specific lawsuit questions conservation projects that were approved by state lawmakers, signed in the state budget by Governor Tony Evers, yet they're not going forward. The funding for those projects are being withheld by the powerful Joint Finance Committee. So this week, liberal justices heard oral arguments on this case, I should say all justices, but the ones that really raised questions and were a little bit skeptical about this were the liberal justices of the power of the legislature that they have to block conservation projects, which is a power that these committees have long had. State government, I should say, has had for nearly over a century. Now, the court held these arguments over projects in the Knowles-Nelson stewardship program, and this also was part of an original lawsuit that included UW pay raises, but that was withheld. Of course, that issue was already settled. First, let's just hear from justices questioning attorneys on this case to give us a little glimpse of what happened in the courtroom.
The logical extension of your argument should have application with respect to rulemaking, which is not at issue in this case, but we can't slice and dice separation of powers. Either we're going to apply it strictly or we're not.
The rule that I'm asking for on the executive power side, and Ms. Dealey will address by cameras, is that a legislative committee may not veto the executive's decisions in implementing a statutory program, including by spending appropriated money. Now, again, I will say the respondents, I've not seen a single case anywhere in the country that blesses this kind of
There doesn't seem to me to be any limits whatsoever. There are zero guardrails here.
Well, Your Honor, there's no, I think, gainsaying that this is exactly how legislative review committee provisions or boards have worked for the last century. And with regard to the practicalities of how the GFC...
Well, maybe they've been wrong for the last century and we shouldn't like double down on how wrong this is. There is zero accountability.
And we've talked about this before, that this case could essentially have ripple effects on state government because it can essentially reshape it for centuries to come.
So interesting to watch. So remember, 4-3 liberal majority. Three liberal justices were fairly aggressive in their questioning. In fact, Joe Karofsky asked at one point, Republicans' attorney, like, done this for a century. Well, yes, what have we been wrong for a century? Like, this isn't really justification to keep doing this. Rebecca Bradley, the conservative, no surprise, very skeptical of anything to limit the legislature's authority. She's a big believer in the powers of the legislative branch. The key is going to be Janet Protasiewicz. Asked a couple of questions, wasn't real vocal during the hearing, but those three liberals, if you telegraph where you're at with your questions, you think they're on the side of the governor. If Janet Jones them, then that changes everything. Now the question, how far do they go? Annette Ziegler, Chief Justice, kept saying, we should be putting this off. We should be finding out more about what could be the impact of this case. It's a little bit too much, maybe, possibly, but if those four liberal side band together, then we know where the case is going to go.
Right, and we've heard from experts and even both sides of the aisle who have concerns about what could be the future impact on this, but that remains to be seen, of course. Speaking of the state Supreme Court, we just want to give an update because, you know, it was just last week that Justice Ann Walsh Bradley announced that she's going to be retiring. We floated three names that are considering a run. We now have confirmation that Dane County Judge Chris Taylor says she is not going to run, and then there's another Dane County Judge, Susan Crossford, who is still considering a bid right now as well.
If you read between the lines of her statement, which is, I'm getting encouragement, I have more to say in the future, she's going to get in.
Mm-hmm.
The question I have left on the progressive side of the aisle is Pedro Colon, appeals court judge in Milwaukee, former state lawmaker, first Hispanic to serve both in the legislature and on the appeals court in Wisconsin. Will he get in? It looks like the kind of powers that be are coalescing around Susan Crawford. candidacy if she gets in because she checks the boxes that have been successful for progressives. She is a sitting judge, she is a former prosecutor, and she's a woman. Those things have worked for Jill Karoski, Rebecca Dallet, Janet Protasiewicz. They want to repeat that formula. On the conservative side, Brad Schimmel, former attorney general, current Washoe County judge, still the only announced conservative in the race. Interestingly, he said this week in a radio interview was that he is not going to turn down legal donations the way that Dan Kelly did. Remember, during the Supreme Court race last year, Daniel Kelly said, I'm not taking direct transfers from the state GOP. He accepted, they're called in-kind contributions. So like if the party does mail for you or does a radio ad, it's called an in-kind donation. But he wouldn't accept a direct transfer of funds. Where Protasiewicz did, big difference. Schimmel's hinting, I'm going to take that money from the party if it can raise it.
I was just going to bring that up on that point up because they are struggling right now a little bit.
So he's preparing for a fight.
All right.
And Maria Lazar, appeals court judge, also still thinking about running in the conservative side as well.
All right. Let's move on to talking about a lot of lawsuits and one that has floated about a possible lawsuit, and that is related to the ongoing fight about PFAS contaminations in our waters. So this week, Governor Tony Evers called a quote-unquote special meeting of the Joint Finance Committee to try to force them to take action on PFAS funding, but GOP lawmakers essentially ignored it. Now, this, of course, was expected. This is the same type of temperament that we get on special session calls that Governor, you know, he does get the headlines, granted, that he wants action on it, but there's no legal parameters that force Republicans to come in and act on this. So Republicans were very quick to dismiss this call from Evers from last week. Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss basically posted on Twitter saying that this is just Evers huffing and puffing with no real substance. Let's hear from Governor Evers first, because what was kind of newsy about this meeting is that Governor Evers floated that he might possibly take legal action if Republicans don't come to an agreement on how best to use this funding. Let's take a listen.
Well, we can run around and go to the Supreme Court on all sorts of things and win, but at the end of the day, we're not getting it out the door. The money is sitting here in Madison. The authority to distribute that is with the Joint Finance Committee, and they've failed. The options are kicking some people out of their positions next November, or getting it out the door, or finding some judge someplace that says that we need to move forward.
Remains to be seen what happens here.
So the rub is Republicans passed a bill. Let's back up a second, I should say. This is a great example of what happens when you have money put aside in the budget, but you have a trailer bill to figure out how to actually spend it. So this has been something Republicans have been doing a lot with Evers in office. They want to have a check on what he does. So the $125 million is in the state coffers. It's sitting there waiting to be used. The trailer bill, there is a difference of opinion between Evers and Republican lawmakers about innocent landowners. So they're people who bought land, have land, didn't put the PFAS there, but it's there. Are they responsible for cleaning it up? Republicans want to protect them. Evers keeps arguing there is a piece, the way that's written, that he fears could undercut DNR authority and protect people who polluted intentionally or possibly contributed to it. They keep going back and forth that they don't know what each other's as I was talking about, but that's the rub. So Republicans keep saying, look, we'll give you the money, but not to give us a plan that we can live with. Governor keeps saying, give me the money, we need to act on this stuff. So they keep going around and around, and there's no end in sight, much like a couple years ago. They wanted to eliminate the personal property tax. They put the money in the budget in 2021. Couldn't agree until 2 years later to actually do it. So could this be a delay again? Possibly. The question is, unless you have PFAS in your backyard, places like up in northeastern Wisconsin, Dane County, Wausau, it's less pressing. So is there really a big push to get this done ahead of this fall, or will they come back and try and take care of it next year in the budget?
It's what's called if it's not in my backyard, right? You know. So, all right, let's now talk about a series of lawsuits that were filed this week, because you know it's Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You know, people can't agree, so they sue each other. First, we're going to talk about the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Litigation Center has filed a legal challenge on behalf of two taxpayers asking the state Supreme Court to strike down Governor Evers' partial veto authority that increased school funding for public schools for 400 plus years. I would hope a lot lot of people remember this because this was a big headline after the state budget. So this was back in July that Evers used his broad veto authority to extend school funding increases for centuries in the state budget, a move that legal experts did predict could face a lawsuit. So this is something that we expected where it was going to come. What comes out of it will be definitely some interesting arguments.
So Governor Scott Walker had a 1,000-year veto in his budget back some years ago. It was challenged in court. The Supreme Court, though, didn't take that up because they basically, look, you guys waited to sue until after Walker left office. It's too late. One of the arguments was, at the time, was whether a governor could strike out numbers. So back in, I think, 1990, voters approved an amendment to the Constitution that banned the Vanna White veto, they used to call it.
Yep.
You can no longer strike individual letters. The question is, does that extend to individual numbers and hyphens in this case? Because Evers took basically a date of 2023 to 24 and combined it to make it 400 years. Can he do that? That's for the court to decide. Interesting to watch how that plays out, too. Remember, this is about the increase in limits on school spending per pupil school spending. That's a mix of state dollars and property taxes. So Republicans keep saying this is a guaranteed property tax increase, which is true if the state doesn't keep pace with how much it's putting into that formula. The state could, in theory, pay for everything in that increase every year. It's a guaranteed increase of $325 per kid every year for four centuries. Now, governors will change between now and 400 years from now. There will be a Republican governor again, probably, in Wisconsin before then. So I would assume they'll change that. They would change that before that 400 years are up. But it is an excellent question of just how far can a governor go, and is he pushing the limits at all in his powers with his veto?
Right, and in the lawsuit, WMC argued that, you know, legislature, those are the ones that should be able to increase property taxes, not through a legislative veto. But, you know, the more that they try to chip away at governor veto authorities, you know, like you mentioned, if there is going to be a Republican governor one day, are they going to be like, oh, shoot, wish we had that? But, you know, this is, once again, Republicans putting a check on Governor Evers in office and trying to counter some of his moves. We also want to mention another lawsuit targeting Governor Tony Evers, which is related to his partial vetoes to a bill that seeks to improve literacy scores in K through 12 schools. Now, they question how JFC would direct $50 million, which is once again still sitting aside, and how this program would eventually evolve.
So, governors can only use their partial veto authority when it's a spending bill, an appropriations bill. The question here is this bill an appropriations bill? Republicans purposely broke up the legislation on this literacy program to separate out the funding, like the actual dollar amount, from language that enabled it. But in that bill, there was provision about directing the money, and Evers basically changed it to like one pot of money, give DPI, Department of Public Instruction, more flexibility in how that money is doled out. The question is, did he go too far? That's the court's decide. Now, if you had a conservative majority in the Supreme Court, like you had pre-2023, I would assume Rebecca Bradley, the conservative justice, would be leading the charge to limit the governor's authority. Again, she's a big fan of legislative authority, the executive branch. But the new constitution of the court, a liberal majority, I'm not sure where they're going to go with this. It's going to be an interesting question to see.
Right. And what this is all about is getting more funding to hire more like reading teachers and changing the model overall for more of like a hooked on phonics approach instead of the current approach that is going on right now. Because we know right now, especially in the Milwaukee area, reading scores are not great on some of those report cards that we get each year from DPI. All right, let's go on to lawsuit number three of this week. And this deals with absentee ballots and specifically voters with disabilities. So they filed, a group of them this week, a new lawsuit claiming that they should be able to submit their ballots electronically. Now, failure to provide that option for the upcoming August primary and November election is quote unquote discriminatory and unconstitutional is what the lawsuit alleges. This, I think, is very interesting because we've seen this in a few other states bring this up to try to give more options for individuals who are blind and can't, you know, or doesn't have assistance at home and physically want to return their ballot. But, you know, this is something that I think I could see Republicans being in a little bit of an uproar about if it is approved.
Wisconsin allowed people to vote absentee electronically up until, well, most people, I believe it was, up until 2011. They changed it to restrict it only to military and permanently overseas voters. This lawsuit argues that this should be extended to those with disabilities. Now, there was a challenge to that law in federal court that was passed in 2011 saying this is too restrictive. The court, then a district court judge, I believe, sided with the plaintiffs, but the appeals court threw it out. But that was to expand it to everybody. This is trying to expand it to one group of people, saying that they need this option to be able to cast a ballot. Otherwise, you're infringing upon their right to privacy when they cast a vote, because they need assistance sometimes. If they need assistance, that person seeing how they're voting, that's not kosher, they argue.
And the reason why I brought up the Republican lawmakers likely going to have some emotions about this,
yes,
is because we all have known that a lot of them have had frustrations about how absentee ballot processes worked overall. They've tried to change the rules to even make it a little bit harder for individuals with disabilities and how they return their ballot, trying to get rid of drop boxes. I mean, many of these issues are likely going to land before the state Supreme Court, but this is something that I can see them being a little bit frustrated mm-hmm. about going forward, but we'll see where that lands. All right, now we're going to highlight the latest Marquette University Law School poll. Of course, we like to look at the head-to-head matchups, and we're going to get to some of the biggest issues consuming the race. We're first going to start with the presidential race, and likely no surprise, it is a tight race here in the battleground state, with President Joe Biden at 49% and former President Donald Trump at 51%. Now getting into the weeds of it, first, important to note, this is among registered and likely voters. Usually there's a little bit of shift in past polls. The last poll done in February had them in a dead heat at a tie. And what I thought was interesting, too, you know, we always talk about swing voters in the battleground state. Where do they go? One kind of key finding in the polling was about 18% of independents, or there was a difference between 18% going to Trump over Biden. But as the poll director, Charles Franklin, noted, that these are voters that really sway back and forth over a series of polls. So we kind of warned caution on those results. Let's just take a listen to Franklin explaining this a little bit more. With independents, Trump has an 18-point lead. Is that telling at all?
Well, I think it's important this month, but in January it would have been Biden with a big lead. You just can't say that this 12% or so of voters are going to stick with that big of a lead. But it's still one that if we start to see consistency over time, then I think we'll start to pay a lot more attention to the group. So if we got two or three polls in a row where independents were consistently on one side, then I would pay a lot more attention to it. But where we've seen them go back and forth over the last three polls, that's why I'm kind of downplaying how much to emphasize independents.
And Jared, there's also some interesting takeaways, too, when you put the five-way primary against the presidential candidates, you know, throwing in the Jill Stein, throwing in the Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in there as well.
So then it goes 41 Trump, 40 Biden, the rest third parties now. People I talked to are a little skeptical that come November we're going to see 19% go to third parties. That'll likely shrink as people go, okay, I have a true binary choice here. These guys aren't likely to win, Trump or Biden, which one I go to. So that was kind of interesting. Second thing, look at the fundamentals of what's going on in this poll. There is almost no reason why Joe Biden should be even close to a challenger. He had a 40% job approval rating. That is not good for an incumbent president. All the fundamentals about concerns about the economy are not working in his favor. The one thing that is people don't like Donald Trump. 59% thought he didn't lack the temperament to be president. More than that, thought he'd acted corruptly, essentially, or does something illegal. That's what's keeping this tight for Biden. The question I have is, we're in mid-April. Can Joe Biden change his numbers with voters? Can he improve? We haven't seen it so far. Since the pullout from Afghanistan and what happened there, he's been on a downward trend and bottomed out and barely been trying to trend up. Can he really reverse things? Or is it all about taking down Donald Trump, which there's a lot of fodder there to go after Donald Trump with, but is that enough? Is abortion enough to go after him? His past problems, these court cases, are those enough to change the name of the race? I don't know. And Trump has the issues for him. I mean, number one, number two are economy and immigration. Number three is abortion. Trump has a lead on the top two issues on voters' minds right now. It's a great sign for Biden.
All right, we're going to get to the issues a little bit later, too. But also what I found interesting is enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. Not too many people are. It's about 47% in this latest poll. When you look at the one in February, it was closer to like 55. But in 2020, enthusiasm was nearly 70%. So a big drop off. Of course, there was a lot more going on in 2020 in the midst of a pandemic. There was a lot of issues that were motivating voters. But still, you can just see there's a lot of people that still just don't want to see the same matchup, which matches a lot of national polls, too.
It's April. wait until October.
Yeah, right.
So those are things I'm watching for, stuff like that.
Just a blimp in time. Yeah. We're still talking about a blimp in time. All right, let's move on to the U.S. Senate race, because this was our first glimpse at the matchup between Senator Tammy Baldwin and Eric Hovde, the Republican. Baldwin had a 52% among registered voters, Eric Hovde at 47%. And then when you throw in likely voters, Baldwin and Hovde are tied at 50%.
So also note that what Charles Franklin is doing is he's pushing voters who undecided to pick one or the other. So he gets to a tie with likely voters by, okay, you're not decided. Who, if you had to pick somebody today, who would you go with? I don't think in mid-April of an election year that there's nobody undecided in the race for U.S. Senate right now. That's not likely. But it shows you, Franklin argued, the sense of partisanship. And asking that question, Baldwin identifies as a Democrat, Hovde is a Republican. We're in a very purple state. The lines are pretty clearly divided. With a +2 race for president for Trump, that probably reflects what's going on. Like, that's how tight it could be. So you drill down the numbers, and there's some good stuff for Hovde, but also some stuff to worry about. Like, 56% of voters don't know who Eric Hovde is, don't have an opinion of him. Granted, it's mid-April. It's a lot of time to do that. I guarantee you by mid-October, he'll be well-known. But there's an opportunity for Hovde to define himself, but also a danger that Baldwin Democrats could define him before he can do that. Now we've seen some things in the news about various things Hovde has said. The latest one's about like this nursing home controversy, if you want to call it that, that Hovde suggests that people in nursing homes are nearing the end of their lives, that there's some question about if they should vote. He keeps saying, there's fraud going on in nursing homes. I've got a concern about it. The way he said it, though, has given Democrats fodder, even Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, wrote a column saying this guy doesn't want old people to vote. Now that's social media fodder for the most part right now in election year. What I'm getting at is there a chance to define Hovde as this guy who's out of touch, who's more interested in California than Wisconsin, who's not out for you kind of thing? Really interesting thing that I saw this week. There's a group, Fix Washington PAC, started doing a couple hundred grand in digital ads up against Baldwin, using the line, "She's not working for us anymore." That is almost the same line she used against Tommy Thompson in 2012. "He's not for us anymore." Just something I picked up this week that kind of I was watching, because they're trying to portray her as a creature of Washington now. Mm-hmm. She's been out there for a long time. Baldwin's calling card's been, "I'm this person who travels the state really well, connects with people. I've got this appeal beyond just Democrats." Are they going to be able to undercut that between now and November?
All right, let's move on to issues. As you already teased, JR, about some of the top two leading issues among registered voters is the economy and immigration and border security, and Trump is winning on them. When you look at this poll, too, you could see there's different colors, red and blue. That's because it's based on the candidates who are winning. So abortion policy, health care, Social Security and Medicaid are blue because those are leading for President Biden. Well, as Trump is still taking up a little bit more of the top few issues. Now, you also heard Trump in Green Bay recently when he was in Wisconsin. He circled back multiple times back to immigration and border security. Of course, he hits on other topics, but that is something even too, talking to voters after the rally, that was the number one concern. Going back to Iowa caucuses, number one concern among voters that I spoke to was still the immigration issue.
Franklin brought up these two questions of the poll that he thought were really interesting. One, he's asked for 12 years. If you're in the country as an undocumented worker, should you be allowed to remain in your job and pursue citizenship? Or should you be allowed to remain in your job but not pursue citizenship, or should you be sent back to your home country? 4 years ago, it was like 60%+ said there should be a path to citizenship. It's down to 49% in this latest poll. He also asked a question that was separated from that question by a bit. Should people here legally be deported? Now, that was favored by more than 60% of people who were surveyed. He pointed out that in the first question, you're asked about people who are here working, okay? The second was just people here illegally. So that wording may have a difference of effect because you take away the association with the job. But two, that first one, the erosion shows you immigration is striking home with people in Wisconsin, even though we are hundreds of miles away from the southern border. It's a potent issue, he said, and that's one to watch this fall.
And with abortion, too, I mean, it still looks good for Biden because we've seen a series of visits by him, too, hitting on this issue. Of course, Vice President Kamala Harris, too, has been hitting on her, you know, road tour as well, talking about that. So they are really banking on that issue. There was also this week a panel from women who were negatively impacted and sharing their stories since Roe was overturned and the abortion restrictions. One was from Texas and Louisiana, had, you know, some pretty difficult times and lost their children and claimed it was due to a lot of their abortion restrictions and their their state. So if that hits home, we'll see. We'll see how powerful that issue will be come November. All right, let's also get to fundraising numbers that you cracked away at this week, JR. These are just the first quarter fundraising numbers. So that's the first 3 months of the year. Looking at U.S. Senate race, Eric Huff D. has an edge. Well, it's because he put $8 million of his own money in there compared to Baldwin, who's at about $5.5 million, too. Looking at the 3rd Congressional District, Representative Derek Van Orden is leading. The Democrats also in the race, that's Rebecca Cook, Katrina Shanklin, and Eric Wilson. 1st Congressional District, of course, we just had Peter Barca, a Democrat, announce, and Diane Henderson, who is a healthcare professional. She hasn't raised any money. Of course, Peter Barca was just announcing yesterday, doesn't have any cash on hand. Brian Stell, the only Republican and incumbent in the race, of course, leading in the pack against Lorenzo Santos, who is another Democrat with about 5,200.
So drill down on the Senate numbers, it's much like the poll. So the top line for the poll is good for Eric Huff D., looks good. Much like being neck and neck with an incumbent, looks good. But if you drill down, so he raised $1.1 million from others. Of that, about 900-some thousand came from individuals. When looking at the strength of a campaign, you have to look at unitemized contributions. There are donations of $200 from donors giving $200 or less. You don't have to put their names and everything in the report. That's why they're all kind of lumped in unitemized. But that's a sign of your small dollar operation. These are the emails that go out, hey, we need help. Our deadline is tomorrow. We're $10,000 short. You have to help us. These donors are hard to reach. You have to cultivate a list of them. It takes money, investment, and time. Huff D. raised about 17% of his donations from individuals from small dollar donors. Baldwin, National Fundraising Network, been doing this for a while, 34.5% roughly, I believe it was. It shows you he has work to do to build that network. Also, the challenge of a self-funder. It's like, okay, if you want me to give you $10 at a pop, but you could put in $8 million, how does that make sense? Like, mm-hmm. That's the thought process, right? That the challenge all self-funders face. Can he get those small dollar donors to get invested personally in his race and give money? Because we've heard $20 million thrown around as the, you know, possible investment from Huff D., but Baldwin's going to raise more than that between now and November, we think. So how does he keep pace unless he can get others invest in the race?
All right, let's get to stock picks this week, and we're going to still talk about the 3rd Congressional District. We have Derek Van Orden rising.
So, look, he outraised, so he has more money in the bank than his two Democratic rivals. They combined, Cook and Shanklin, to outraise him, but they have a primary coming up. They're going to blow most of that money trying to win the nomination, and the fundamentals still favor Van Orden. If you look at 2022, Governor Evers won that seat, you know, won it, got more votes than Tim Michaels, as he won statewide by 3.4 percentage points. Find me somebody who thinks Joe Biden's going to win statewide by 3.4 percentage points right now, okay? Mm-hmm. So if that's a 50-50 race, top of ticket, that district tilts toward Donald Trump. He won it, but the old version in 2016-2020, expected well again. Most vulnerable incumbent Republican House members don't want Donald Trump on their, like, around their neck. He wants to bear hug him because Trump's going to do well out there. So the Democrats, can they keep raising money? Probably a bigger thing, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, will it invest in the Western Wisconsin? 2 years ago, they had TV ads reserved the last couple weeks of the race for Brad Paff. They pulled them out one by one. Look, if they're not investing in late September or October in that race, they're not serious about it. And that's what I'm watching for. If the DCCC comes in and spends money early for either Cook or Shanklin whoever emerges, that's a real race. If they don't, Van Orden's in good shape.
All right, let's get to Mix this week, which is Peter Barker, who is the most well-known Democrat who just launched a bid for the 1st Congressional District, a district that got a little bit more competitive under the new legislative maps adopted in 2022, but it's still very reliably red.
So, look, this district, it tilts Republican a little bit. So Brian Stiehl won by just shy of 9 points in 2022. Hadn't had a tough race, really, since he won it in 2018. $4 million in the bank. Like, you add those things up, it's not a great place to be if you're a Democratic challenger. But Peter Barca may be, one, believing he can win, and two, doing a favor for the team. What I mean by that is, this race topic, we may be the deciding state in the presidential race in Wisconsin. You want somebody in every seat you can to drive turnout. There are Democrats who aren't thrilled about Joe Biden. Can Peter Barca excite some Democrats to turn out? This bottom-up theory, see if it works. But having Barca there is better than not having Barca there. Now, I don't want to dismiss Santos or Anderson, but Peter Barca is going to have support from establishment Democrats. He's going to raise money. He's former member of Congress, was there for about 93-94 for a lawsuit in the GOP wave. He had two stints in the Assembly, part of the Clinton administration. The guy's a former revenue secretary for Evers. He's an Energizer bunny
when it
comes to doing stuff at 68 years old. He will work that district. He will bring out Democrats. Can he win it? That may be a tall task right now, but he's definitely makes it more interesting than it would be otherwise.
Definitely. All right, following this week is Milwaukee crime.
So you wouldn't tell from the campaign trail for the presidency, but crime is down in a lot of major cities right now, homicide especially. Milwaukee has followed that national trend. I want to bring up, though, is don't expect Donald Trump to back off his description of our major cities as basically like these horrible wastelands that have run amok. There's a narrative there. And also, too, it's interesting is the public doesn't feel safer, even with these numbers going down. It's been going down, I think, for more than a year now.
Since the pandemic, yes.
But the perception is there's still this dangerous atmosphere out there. It is a great issue for Republicans. They're going to keep hammering on it between now and the election.
All right, that will do it for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.